Welcome to the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show. Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 253 of the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley. And today's episode is on, what is animal-assisted psychotherapy? And it's the 17th of February 2023 as I record this. And today's episode, I think, is rather brilliant because I originally started this about an hour ago, thinking, right, this is going to be a really nice short blog post. It won't take me too long. It ended up being quite a normal length. And I love that because I really do get quite critical about animal-assisted psychotherapies. I'm definitely able to do quite a lot of critical thinking, and this episode's just fun, and I think it's just funny that I wanted something quite easy, something really, really short. My mind just did not go there, but it's what I love the podcast, I love psychology, and yeah, this has just been a really, really fun one. So you've got that to look forward to in the content part of today's episode, and I highly recommend this episode. So moving on to the psychology news section, we're reading from the British Psychological Society Research Digest, and the first one I've never heard of at all. Humour bragging helps candidates rise to the top. If you're applying for a new job, highlighting your accomplishments is a must. Doing so without coming across as arrogant or boastful, however, can be a challenge all of its own. Striking the perfect balance between serious, competent, capable, and likeable is super tricky. Previous research has shown that using self-deprecating humour to downplay your achievement might make you seem more likeable, but perhaps also give the impression that you're less competent than you really are. Now though, a new paper in Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin describes a method for conveying both competence and likability. This research, led by Lee Paul at Imperial College London, suggests that humour bragging can help job applicants and entrepreneurs rise to the top of the pile. Okay, so I definitely think that this one's definitely one of the more applied psychology articles that we cover on the podcast, because I think if we all go away and actually Google humour bragging and we test it out, we practice a little, then this is what we can actually use in everyday lives. And I mean, like, the job market is just bad enough as it is. Like, it's really competitive, especially in psychology, because even though I always say that one of the reasons why I chose psychology actually was because you cannot get a job in psychology without a degree and a master's degree, but there are still tens of thousands of other people that have the exact same degree as you. So it's your skills, it's your interests, it's your passion, and it's your humour bragging, apparently. That can really help you stand out. So I really do think that we should check it out. And I think that I also want to talk about a slightly wider point here when it comes to employability. Of course, this is not official advice. First, I just want to make some general points here, because I've been working an applicant day today as a student and an ambassador, and I had to give a campus tour. Now, I actually quite like campus tours, but they're always amusing, especially when you leave with a group of 15 applicants and you come back with 3, because they all decide to go home. I promise you that I did not do that bad of a job. It was getting like quite late in the day and they had sort of seen the bits that they wanted to. And everyone actually stressed how helpful I was like being to them. But one of the points I actually made to them was outside our university's nightclub, club, is that you have the student media bit. So I was saying that when you go to university, yes, you will get a degree if you try hard, etc., but you need to tailor your university experience. So you need to develop your interests, gain employability, make yourself, to be honest, interesting, and just enjoy it. Because university is so much more than learning. So I think that's just like, to be honest, quite a massive segue and quite a massive like tangent from this article, but it's still important. So the second one is, crossing gender stereotypes helps, I'm sorry, go further. Not all apologies are created equal. We all know that some kinds of apologies are generally more effective than others, and previous research shows us that their success, at least in part, can be influenced by the gender of the person giving them. How much of that is set in stone? Writing in the Journal of Applied Psychology, Beth Pollin, her US-based colleagues, take a closer look at the content of apologies, as well as how closely they conform to gender stereotypes, influences their effectiveness. Across 4 studies in a variety of contexts, they show that apologies which fly in the face of gender stereotypes were seen as an average 9.7% more effective for women and 8.2% more effective for men. Okay, so this I think is absolutely fascinating because we really are doing applied psychology news articles today, because this is another one we can actually use in everyday life. And I guess the reason why I'm getting quite excited about this is that because we all know there's tons of psychology research you cannot use in everyday life. And I think this one's also quite personally interesting. Is that because of my upbringing and because of my childhood? And how I was made to feel at times, I over-apologise a lot. I mean, like, one of my friends almost, they didn't shout at me, but in text, it sort of read as them shouting at me, and because I was just bugging them, because I was always, like apologising whenever I thought that I'd made a mistake, they sort of just lost the rag, like, with me. So I think apologising is always an interesting one, because, to be honest, I know this and I'm a lot better than I used to be, but we should only apologise when we've done something wrong there. And yes, that is hard to recognise at times, but we should, and we shouldn't over-apologise, otherwise the word I'm sorry from you becomes meaningless, as I'm learning. But anyway though, I can definitely understand how we're gender stereotypes, because if we use stereotypes here, the stereotype that comes to my mind is women that give more empathetic, more of emotional apologies. Okay, then, that I can understand. So I can understand that if men try to be more emotional, more sincere, more open and more, I don't know, I really don't know stereotypes, because I tend to avoid them as much as I possibly can. But if men try to do that, then I can see how that could make someone that think they're being more sincere and they're giving a more meaningful apology. So I think that this is just something you like to bear in mind. When we're trying to give apologies, try and be as sincere as you can, but also try and fly in the face of gender stereotypes. So the last one is, babies can link sight and touch at 4 months. And this is where we break the trend, because we can't use this in everyday life. To play sport or simply walk safely down the road, we need an awareness of how our body interacts with other objects. This requires us to integrate sensory signals about things happening around us, such as the sight of a ball approaching, with sensory signals on the body, such as the touch of the ball whacking into our hands. Though most adults have a good awareness of their peripersonal space, I think that's such a triggering word from my final year of my undergrad, and it can manage this without any problem, exactly when this ability emerges has remained unclear. Now, a new paper from the University of Birmingham's Baby Lab finds that even four-month-old babies are capable of linking the sight of an object in this space with touch sensations on their hands. Given that most babies learn to consistently grasp objects at about 5 months of age, this is a pretty surprising finding. So whilst developmental psychology is definitely not my area, even though I tend to cover it quite a bit on the podcast from time to time, and cognitive psychology, especially peripersonal space, I try to lord like the plague after my undergrad, because that entire module I hated. But peripersonal space was actually quite a useful concept. So it's basically like the space around us. And to be honest, it's what normal people call personal space, to be honest. That's the easiest way to explain it. So even though I can't really say too much about this specific article, well, because this is not my area, well, I definitely think that it's quite a surprising finding that babies as young as 4 months old can do such incredible and such, to be honest, complex stuff. Because, I mean, like, this is not easy. We need to incorporate different sensory signals. We need to be honest, we need to convert them from sight. And we also need to realise that feeling of something whacking into our hand is actually that particular object. So this stuff sounds really simple, but if you really think about it and you think about all the different processes, that just understanding that and those, I do think it's quite incredible, and it's just really fun to think about. So I hope you enjoy the psychology news section. So let's move on to the personal update. So we're moving on to the personal update. So this week has been such a strange week. And I mean, I want to stress how strange it is, because there are quite a few different points that I can actually make here, especially towards the end of the week, mainly because I can actually remember the last of the week. So all I remember from the first part of the week is me not being that productive, because I was dealing with quite a lot of mental health stuff and just different feelings of, to be honest, I'm not really sure I know how to describe what was going on. Not because, yeah, because because there were just a few different reasons. So that I dealt with quite quickly. Wednesday was a wonderfully intense day though, where because I had meetings, including some very exciting opportunities that might be coming up for me. And believe me, there will be podcast episodes about these things. I might get one of my friends to come on the podcast for two different reasons, because one, they're starting a new job, and I think the podcast will definitely benefit them, because they can do promotion on the podcast, and I would just love to talk to them about the work specifically. And also it means I get to talk to them about their PhD, but again, that will not be till in the summer, definitely in the summer. Yes, and then I was a socialising outreach worker, doing some very exciting live stuff. So Wednesday was just really, really busy. Busy though, and quite a night tense. But the reason why I'm actually talking about this week is because on Thursday, as part of me trying to salvage the week, is that I did my ethics application. One for brand new psychology study. And the reason why I'm talking about this is, one, because it's research, it's my experience as a psychology master's student though. But something I loved about this particular ethics application is how much of it was just copy and paste from my last study. I didn't have to do too much rewriting. I could just copy and paste a whole bunch of stuff from my old ethics application, and that was so easy. It still took me half an hour, because I was taking my time, I was making sure that everything was correct, and I did have to do some rewriting, but it was so useful and it was really, really easy. So my supervisor has to approve of the ethics application, then the ethics board has to approve it, and that would take about 2 weeks, and then I can get cracking with another study and another psychology study, which I'm really, really excited about. I'm not sure if I've mentioned what that topic is. I'm going to wait till the study's launched and then I will talk about it on the podcast. I'm so excited about this one because I was talking to a friend actually, and just I really am loving psychology research at the moment, because I think that for your undergrad, you do psychology research because you're given it, you have to do it, you don't get a choice on the topic. But in master's, there is more flexibility. And if there's a psychology topic that you want to look at, if there's something you're passionate about, you can investigate it a lot more at master's level, because you are sort of given that freedom a little bit more, at least in my like experience. So that certainly helped to make my master's a lot more fun and a lot more beneficial, because now me and my supervisor, we're going to write these up as like papers, we're going to try and get these academically published, and I'm definitely really, really excited. And then something else I wanted to mention was, so today at my university, I was working this applicant day, and I met this woman because there was this mother and a daughter, and they were really nice. I was talking like to them. The daughter really wanted to do clinical psychology, and I was talking with the mother, and she turned around and said something I can't quite believe. She turned around and said, "Oh, you want to work in the NHS? You want to work with the general populace? You're going to have to pretend that you care about them and their problems." So I did the diplomatic thing. I did the smile. I did the waving. I did the nodded. I fake greet with her. And it was just like, what the hell did she mean by that? It was like, how dare you think that just because people can't afford private healthcare, and believe me, this woman was giving off those lives. Like, I would not be surprised if this woman thought that the NHS, which is the UK's public health system, should just be destroyed and everyone should be made to pay medical insurance. And it was just like, what? And just like, how dare she think that clinical psychology should only go private because that's where the money is? I mean, like, just because people don't have enough money to get medical insurance, just because they want the free option of the NHS, doesn't mean they're anything less. And yes, I'm missing some context for you, but these are all the vibes she was giving off. And it was like, how dare you say that about clinical psychology? How dare you imply that I shouldn't care about the general populace just because they aren't rich and stuff? And it's like, I was so... Now I'm just so annoyed at her, because it's like, I am not in clinical psychology. I do not want to work in clinical psychology for the money, or just so I can only deal with people that are really rich and they can afford private healthcare. How dare she say that? I'm in clinical psychology because I want to help people. I do not care how much money they make. I do not care if they have public or private medical health. I'm here. I want to work in clinical psychology to help people, to save lives if one of them's suicidal, etc. It's just like, oh my god. I mean, like, I think you can tell in my voice how frustrated I am with this woman. So I think the reason why I'm mentioning this is because you will meet people like that in the general public, or hell, the general populace. Oh my god, can't believe she said that. And yeah, people might judge you. People might think that, oh, you're wasting your time because you want to work in the public health sector, but you're not. You are amazing for wanting to work in any form of psychology that deals with other people. Whether you're a business psychologist, a forensic psychologist, a clinical psychologist, you're amazing because you actually want to help people. And you don't care about how much money they make or how much money you could make. Because yes, I could make probably a lot more money in the private sector in the future. But no, I want to work in the NHS because it's where the normal people are the people that need my help. And to be honest, yes, you have to work in there to get qualified. But even then, the NHS is not perfect. It has tons of problems. I've spoken about most of them in my books and on the podcast. I still want to work in there, though. So, yeah, To say I was frustrated with her was an understatement. And now I'm really letting my anger come out. And yes, so I just wanted to give that little flavour of life for you. And there was something else I was going to mention, but to be honest, it's not important after I spoke about that. Well, it's just some family health stuff. And, oh, yeah, my autism diagnosis. I went for that doctor's appointment, but that was a whole kerfuffle, which, to be honest, does support the woman's point. But I'm not going to talk about that. So, as always, I always love to know your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can just email me, ConnorWhiteley@ConnorWhiteley.net. You can always leave a comment at the show notes at ConnorWhiteley.net/podcast. And you can always tweet me at SciFiWhiteley. I always love to hear from all of you because it really helps make the podcast feel more like a conversation. And today's episode has been sponsored by Working with Children and Young People, a guide to clinical psychology, mental health and psychotherapy. So this is a great sponsor for today's episode because even though I'm not a massive fan of animal-assisted therapy, I actually wanted to talk about an entire mental health sector and an entire mental health setting where you would do help children and young people because there's a clinical population does have like a specific needs. And psychologists actually work with a wide range of different mental health professionals, to assess and improve the lives of the children and the younger people. So this great, really easy to understand book covers a wide range of areas. For example, child and adolescent mental health services, which might be more of a UK focus, but those sections are still applied a lot of really good information from a wide range of different countries, and it helps to give you a flavour of what working with children and adolescents is like. But then we also talk about paediatric psychology, which is a lot more interesting than I ever thought possible. And then we also talk about child development centres, which is a very psychology focused. And the entire point of this book is just to help you understand how can it be used and how can it be adapted to best suit the needs and improve the lives of the children and young people. So I really enjoyed it because there's also quite a few autism chapters. So it's really good. It gives you quite a lot of information, high quality information that goes into quite a lot of depth. So I enjoyed it. I really do recommend it. So that is Working with Children and Young People, a guide to clinical psychology, mental health and psychotherapy, available from all major ebook retailers, and you can order the paperback and the hardback version from Amazon, local bookstore or local library if you've requested, and you can get the audiobook version narrated by artificial intelligence from selected audiobook retailers like Kobo, Google Play, Spotify, and a certain library systems if you request it. So whilst buying books helps to support the creation and the editing of the podcast, my time is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And as always, a massive thank you to my patrons because your support shows that you like the show and that you want it to continue. So if you want to become a patron of the show and get tons of great rewards, now you can at patreon.com psychologyworldpodcast. So now the personal update's done, let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So moving on to the content part of today's episode. So we're going to be talking about what is animal-assisted therapy. And this is a really good podcast episode. I definitely get quite critically thinking about this. And I just want to say that all the references for today's podcast episode is available on the blog post at conwiley.net/podcast. And there are tons of references today. So if you wanted to explore this deeper, then definitely head on over to the website. So let's dive into it. Animal-assisted therapy is a type of psychological therapy that involves different animals. For example, dogs, cats, birds and horses, and incorporates these animals into a client's treatment plan. Then the therapist, client and animal work together to complete therapeutic activities outlined in the treatment plan, with these activities having defined goals to help the client reach the therapeutic outcomes they desire. Interestingly, animal-assisted therapy can take many forms, depending on the client, the therapy's goals and the animal, as well as that this therapy isn't actually used as an alternative to traditional therapy, because at times this can enhance or complement traditional therapies. Personally, I cannot get my head around using animals in therapy, that's why the next section is important. How does animal-assisted therapy work? So, interestingly enough, the idea behind animal-assisted therapy is that there is a bond between people and animals. This is something that I can fully support because I've seen this from dog and cat lovers and owners. And other pet owners love their pets like they would another human. People seriously love for their animals, so this is a logical idea. This works because animals can provide people with a sense of safety or comfort or calm, as well as they can divert attention away from stressful situations. In addition, animals can be useful both for combating loneliness, and they can boost social support too. And in our Tristanite story here. So as I mentioned earlier, then today I was actually working at a university then as an applicant day. And this mother had dabbled her daughter and her dog. And the mother was one of the most popular people at the applicant day. Tons of people wanted to interact with her and the dog. Therefore, animals are a source of social support and interaction, as the client interacts with the animal itself and other people interact with the client because of the animal. Also, animals can make people get more physical activity than they would normally, and we know the mental health benefits of a physical activity. For example, a dog owner having to go on walks with their dog in that fresh air could have a positive impact on their mental health. As a result, supporters of animal assisted therapy say that animal assisted therapy works because it gets the client to develop a bond with an animal. Then this helps the client to develop an increased sense of trust, self-worth and stabilized emotions, as well as it improves their social skills, self-regulation and communication skills. Personally, I do have some thoughts on the explanation of how it works. Firstly, I can fully understand how this could work because I understand how an animal liking a client and wanting to be with a client could increase those feelings of trust and self-worth, as well as the increased physical activity and improved communication and social skills that the client gets to practice by people wanting to stroke the dog or something. That would be useful. However, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, then you know I am a massive fan of cognitive behavioural approaches, because they aren't perfect, but they're really good. They're really well researched and they're really effective. Therefore, if we look at animal-assisted therapy alone, so I'm not saying that this is a part or complemented of a traditional therapy, then how-assisted therapy helps you to change a client's faulty thinking patterns. How does animal therapy and a bond with an animal help the client to realise any cognitive biases they have? And leaning more into humanistic approaches here, how does a bond with an animal help a client to realise that they have all of the answers that they need for their mental health difficulties? And yes, I'm harking back to the person-centred psychotherapy episode from last August or September, one of the two. Moreover, how does an animal help with cognitive restructuring? As well as to a lesser extent, how could a bond with an animal help behavioural activation as much as traditional therapy? Of course, these are massively generalised questions that are not right for every single client, but I use them to highlight several key points about animal-assisted therapy and the issues of how it is meant to work. When is animal-assisted therapy used? Building upon its flaws in how it's meant to work, there are a few more issues in when this therapy is used, but we'll talk more about that in a moment. As a result, animal-assisted therapy can be used for groups or in individuals with a wide range of mental health difficulties or conditions. For example, animal-assisted therapy can be useful for people with autism, ADHD, stress, anxiety, depression, addiction, emotional and behavioural problems in children, schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease, and some medical conditions. In addition, I can see how this therapy could be useful for these conditions and difficulties. For example, autism results in people having difficulties with human interactions, and animals are a lot easier than humans to deal with. Believe me, I know. So I suppose helping an autistic person bond with an animal could be a useful way to teach them skills that use with humans. However, anxiety and depression are still two conditions I don't understand with animal-assisted therapy, especially when we take the therapeutic orientation that cognitive behavioural approaches employ. And here's a useful egg extract from CBT for anxiety of what an anxiety disorder is made up of. Open quote. There's a cognitive component relating to the person's unrealistic thoughts about their fears of loss of control and how they exaggerate the danger. Then there is an emotional component too that focuses on how the disorder causes a person's terror, irritability and a panic. Furthermore, an anxiety disorder has a physical component that is responsible for a person's activation of the hormonal system and empathetic nervous system, resulting in their flight or flight response to be activated. This is also the same component causing heart palpitations and sweating, as well as there's a behavioural factor of the disorder that causes an anxious person to change their behaviour, like developing maladaptive coping mechanisms, like avoiding the source of their anxiety. Now, I bring this up because CBT has to deal with these four areas as part of the treatment. I do not understand how animal-assisted therapy deals with, to be honest, any of those components, but let's just focus on the cognitive component here. Because if the therapy uses animals as a source of comfort, then I'm taking the approach that I'm arguing that that's a safety behaviour, a behaviour that we believe is helpful, but it isn't in the long term, because we think the only reason why horrible things didn't happen is because of the safety behaviour. So I argue making a client believe that a dog or another animal is the only reason why they aren't anxious in the presence of a stimuli is a safety behaviour, since if you were to take out the dog away, then the client might believe horrible things will happen to them because the animal isn't there to support them. That's just one area of anxiety that I don't believe animal-assisted FRP explains it very well, at least from a theoretical concept. I would explain more, but I am sort of aware of the length of this podcast episode would be if that was the case. Like, if I explained the other three areas, this might be a 3,000-word podcast episode, if not 3,500. Effectiveness of animal-assisted FRP. Another two issues with this type of psychotherapy is that the therapy isn't good for people who are scared, don't like, or allergic to animals. As well as there is research showing that animal-assisted therapy can help a lot of people, but its effectiveness is sort of questionable. The reason for this is because the existing clinical trials are methodologically flawed according to research, and there are so many references to that. Just please go and check out the reference section of today's podcast episode. Therefore, better research studies are needed to truly assess how effective this therapy is for clients. What should someone expect in animal-assisted therapy? When it comes to this type of therapy, a client can expect to work with some kind of animal. It might be a cat, dog, or another pet. And this pet cannot be kept at home, or it can be with you throughout the day for emotional support. Or a client's therapy might involve learning to care or ride from a therapy horse. It all depends on the type of animal therapy a client goes for. Afterwards, a client and their therapist could talk about the animal whilst a client is working with them, or the two might set aside time to talk about the client's experiences. Now, I flat out do not have an issue with animal-assisted therapy in community settings, like a school, hospital, nursing home, and rehabilitation centre, due to these settings are critical mental health settings. Yet, I'm very iffy about these settings when it comes to animal-assisted therapy, because a qualified psychotherapist might not be used. Instead, a volunteer might deliver the therapy. Of course, this is a trained volunteer. And before I make my point, I should also say that brief psychological interventions, BPIs, are also delivered by a trained volunteer, and they are effective. I've spoken about that before. However, my problem is still the problem that fully qualified psychologists have with BPIs. Psychologists trained for years and years to deliver highly effective psychological interventions, and then some volunteers get trained up to do our work for us in a much, much shorter time span. Honestly, if it works, it works. And as long as it helps our clients, I do actually see a portrait. But it is just annoying that when we have to train for years and years, there are ways for other people to get trained in psychological interventions in a much shorter time span. Again, that's just a little nitpick. And to be honest, I do remember that criticism and that conversation in my BPI lecture very, very well, because the lecturer was sort of quite annoyed at it. Well, I mean, she could see it from both sides, but I think it did annoy her. And I think it did sort of annoy quite a few of her colleagues too, even though they were the people that developed this in the first place. And whilst I do know that BPIs are very, very different from animal-assisted therapies, I still think the points are sort of like parallel here. So that's why I wanted to mention it. Conclusion. So originally I picked this podcast episode because I thought it was going to be short and to be honest, really easy. Of course, it turns out I quite like to critically think about stuff, so there was a lot to unpack here. Personally, I'm not totally against animal-assisted therapy, because It helps some people. But I think I need a lot more high-quality studies before I would ever call myself a supporter of this therapy. I think the evidence and the theoretical basis of this therapy are questionable at times. And as much as I sort of want a dog, in fact, I actually do want a dog, like this blog post actually made me realise how much I do actually want a dog. I don't think I'm enough of an animal person. I would want to spend my days working with animals in a psychological therapy. I prefer traditional psychotherapies, like cognitive behavioural therapy, and I do enjoy drawing on systemic and humanistic approaches too, at times. Therefore, just as a reminder, animal-assisted therapy is a type of psychological therapy that involves different animals, like cats, dogs, birds, horses, and it incorporates animals into a client's treatment plan. Then the therapist, client, and animal work together to complete therapeutic activities outlined in the treatment plan, with these activities having defined goals and to help the client to reach the therapeutic outcomes that they desire. Finally, if animal-assisted therapies work for particular clients, then that is brilliant, and I wish all these people the best of luck. But personally, I'll be sticking with therapies that have a strong research base, and they do not use animals in a therapeutic setting. That's just my personal taste, but if you like the sound of animal therapies, then go for it. Life is way too short not to do something that you love. So if you love animals and working with them, then go and investigate animal-assisted therapy. You will never know how much you might be able to help a client decrease their psychological distress, improve their lives, and make them smile. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode and you got something out of it. I didn't think it was going to be as long as it was, but I enjoy this stuff. I love therapies, I love clinical psychology, and after the week I've had, this has just been such a highlight. I mean, like, that's how weird my week's been, that just talking to wonderful people for, I have no idea how long the actual episode will be, but I think I've been recording for like 45 minutes. It's just lovely talking like to all of you, and I love psychology, even the weird stuff like today's episode, or the less empirical stuff. But that's why I look at it, it's why I learn about it, just so I can go, oh, in future, yeah, I'm going to stay away from this, because this is not scientific enough for me. But then again, one of the reasons why it's not scientific enough at the moment is just because of the methodological flaws. So if you're interested in this, look at it, learn it, think about it. So if you know someone who would enjoy today's episode, then please share it with them. I'm always really grateful when you wonderful people help spread the word about the podcasts. And if you want to learn more, definitely check out Working with Children and Younger People, available in all the usual places, and you can get the AI narrated audiobook version at selected audiobook retailers. And if you want to become a patron, then now you can at patreon.com/ The Psychology World Podcast. So have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. Please remember to like the video and subscribe to the YouTube channel and follow the podcast on your favourite podcast app. And if you wanted to learn more, then please check out the backlist of the podcast episodes or my books at conwhiteley.net. So have a great day and I'll see you next time.